It's the Nuclear Salmon edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, securing the Olympics, the politics of polio, nuclear salmon, and what's Ethan's problem with the War of 1812? Now let's begin episode 175.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The
cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, it is funny how fate just twists things around. I've been reading a number of reports, you know, and we've talked about the show about airport security in the United States and how kind of crazy it's all gotten. Well, there have been a couple of stories this week that I thought was just so apropos. It's like, it's almost worth all the pain people have been going through. The first one I was listening to is that one guy was going through airport security and they were doing sort of the pat down. You know, and part of the pat down is they go up the inside of your leg and they kind of feel your crotch and make sure that you're not hiding anything there. And this security guard said sort of, "What have you got there?" And he says, "It's just me." He says, "No, that's way too big. What have you got there?" And as it turns out, it was the guy with the world's largest penis. It's like 13 or 14 inches long. But the security people did not believe him that it was his member, and they forced him to sort of whip it out and prove it, which I just thought was kind of funny.
It makes you wonder, like, was he sort of secretly hoping they would do that? Like, if you had the world's largest penis, would you be eager to show it off?
Yeah, to a degree. From what I understand, he hasn't done a lot of like porn or anything. There's been a few documentaries, ironically enough, that I've seen about him because I go into weird things about what's unusual in the world. He doesn't strike me as sort of an attention getter, but at the same time, I'm quite sure he was just sitting back with a huge smile on his face going, "You're going to get such a surprise."
Hmm. Well, speaking of surprises, the other interesting event at the TSA also involves some nudity.
It does. It does. Apparently, again, someone was going through one of these pat downs and they said, "Well, you know, we want you to go over here and we want to do a better check of you." And he was so infuriated by all this, he just stripped down naked and said, "There you go. You want to look at it all? Just look at it all." And they, of course, arrested him for indecent exposure. But as it turned out, he went to court and they said, no, it was actually a form of political speech because he was protesting the insanity of this, you know, frisk and search thing at the airport.
So basically his nakedness is free speech.
Yes, which I think a lot of women in the news and that are trying to go for this topless thing, right? Should women be allowed to walk around topless like men do? And maybe in a sense, maybe if you consider that to be free speech, why shouldn't the body be free speech? If money can be free speech, why not the body?
Why not the body?
Speaking of security, you may have heard that there is something coming up in London called the Olympics. There was a lot of controversy in Vancouver when the Olympics were here. One of the major kerfuffles was about spending on security. The original estimate was about $20 million, but it ended up costing something a little north of $1 billion. Now, as I say, as we're starting to approach the 2012 Summer Games in London, it's interesting to see how security is going to be handled there. Now, first, the estimates are about $1.6 billion and over 40,000 security personnel, which is a lot of people, although apparently not that exponentially different from original estimate. Now, you could say that all that money is kind of overkill. And let's remember, there have only actually been really two incidences of Olympic terrorism. There was the political murder of Israeli athletes at the Munich Games in the 70s and the backpack bomber of the Atlanta Games in the 90s. Of course, the former, where sort of this enhanced security might have been helpful, it kind of actually proved to be a counterproductive action by the terrorists itself. It seems that people didn't really think it was appropriate to make a political statement by hitting innocent athletes. So in a way, it's good protection, but for a threat that no longer exists. And of course, the latter is your sort of lone wolf sort of thing. And history's kind of shown there's no real deterrent for that sort of thing. Now, of course, I could go off on one of my rants about how the Olympics have become sort of a cash cow for corporations, but I'll save that for another day. What is a thought of interest, though, is this sort of there's a new escalation. Now, of course, you might ask, what's the need for an escalation of security measures when the pass level seems to have proven adequate? But again, we'll just sort of run with it. Now, besides the sort of rent-a-cop security, which actually in itself is a bit of a scandal, the UK government decided to hand out a mega contract to provide low-level security to a single company, which then failed to recruit the number of people because, from what I understand, and this is subject to confirmation, it was just too expensive for them to do it, so they didn't bother to hire the people. There is expected to be anywhere from about 27 to 17,000 armed forces to be deployed. The original number was 17,000, but because of the shortfall in rent-a-cop sort of department, they're deploying apparently 10,000 more troops, so I'm not sure of the exact numbers. There, of course, are going to be warships on the Thames. There's going to be other military vehicles out there, as well as military batteries on apartment building.
Military missile batteries.
Yes, yes. You got that last one.
So they're actually expecting that this is how Spain is going to get them back for the Spanish Armada being destroyed.
Something like that. The UK government is placing 6 anti-aircraft batteries on top of buildings in the heart of the city, including 4 of them on apartment blocks. And this is all apparently legal. They went to court. The people who lived in the apartment buildings were obviously none too thrilled about this particular development. They went to court, but they lost. So I thought, well, let's just sort of think this through. Now, if there were to be sort of another 9/11 attack, and I think this is the only sort of likely attack, as you kind of pointed out, Ethan, I don't think there's any chance that like the Syrian Air Force is going to carpet bomb London or something like that. So really, this is intended to stop sort of the 9/11, take a plane, crash it into a building, kill hundreds of people sort of attack. Now, I think it's true that if you could stop such a plane over farmland, then it might prevent a major disaster, and ideally, if something like that happens. However, the rockets that they're using are Rapier and Starstreak missiles, which have a range of about 6 kilometers. Pause. London is 45-ish kilometers in diameter. Pause. And they're in the heart of the city. Conclusion? If you strike down a plane, what's going to happen about it? Well, let's just think it through. A plane's coming through. It's going to destroy a stadium or something. It gets past sort of the outer defenses and is now in the city. You then fire your rockets and you destroy the plane. But as I say, where is it going to go? Best case scenario is you have a rainstorm of flaming metal shards showering down over kilometers of downtown London, which I am sure is going to kill hundreds of people. Hopefully not, but if that's one scenario. Another scenario is you disable the plane and it crashes into another non-targeted building, again, killing hundreds of people. Worst case scenario, of course, is you miss the target altogether. It slams into a building, killing however many people that. The rocket itself, having missed the target, slams into another building, and you get a double bang for the buck. Now, of course, I've been saying hundreds of people because, well, the Twin Towers, thousands of people died in it, but it was kind of a fluke, I think. There isn't really a similar kind of target in London for them to go after. And, of course, let's not forget the biological, chemical, or nuclear sort of scenarios, where, again, if you blow up the plane, that really doesn't make a difference as far as who's going to lose their lives. Now, there is, of course, another possible terrorist target, the launchers themselves. Not only would you kill hundreds of people, assuming that the people in the apartment blocks stayed there with the rocket launchers on the roof, but it's also sort of a symbolic military target. And, you know, it doesn't have that same sort of ugliness of killing athletes. So in an odd sort of way, putting up these rocket launchers have made it more likely for there to be a terrorist attack during the games, but on them themselves. Now, of course, if my predictions are right, and I hope they're not, but if they are, expect my book about my psychic powers to be published sometime in this fall, available $29.99.
$29.99, eh? That's pricey. You know, I mean, this is really an unfortunate example of security theater, and this is something that I think we've actually been talking about fairly recently in the skeptical community because it relates back to that big debate that happened with Sam Harris over racial profiling. And in this case, you have this paranoid overreaction that there's going to be some kind of massive disaster at the Olympic Games. And don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not like it's not a tempting target for a terrorist, but you have to keep in mind what a terrorist has at their disposal. And most terrorists, don't have access to the kind of weaponry or resources to launch a large-scale attack on one of the biggest cities in the world. What they do have resources are for things like blowing up cars, maybe buildings in places like Baghdad or other places where their security isn't as tight. And, you know, when you're talking about, say, the Olympics here, and of course everybody wants to be safe, everybody wants to be secure, but you got to remember what your actual threats are as well. So you have a bunch of people in a city, there's going to be lots of alcohol, there's going to be lots of adventures going on, people are going to be watching sporting events. You know, things that could go wrong are like a riot or some looting or, you know, drunken disobedience. It seems to me that you'd be far better off putting a cap on those type of situations than worrying about like a large scale military strike by the most powerful terrorist in the history of the world.
Well, and you double down on that if you think about it, because, I mean, there will be like Navy ships on the Thames, and I'm sure they're not there to prevent the Spanish Armada attacking England. I'm sure they're there for the surface-to-air missiles to sort of double down on this, well, there's going to be a 9/11 type attack. But you mentioned drinking, and ironically enough, the most famous place for alcoholics or people who drink a lot is Glasgow. And a lot of the Olympic venues are actually not in London. They're actually going to be dispersed throughout England in general, especially things like soccer and that. So in an odd way, again, you know, if you're real concerned with security, this seems to be, one, a bit of a boondoggle. But second of all, you're just sort of shifting cups around because you just made the other places a lot more easier targets to hit.
Well, exactly. And of course, there is that kind of rather silly game that it almost seems like it's more sort of like, look at what we have, look what we can do. Almost like they were showing off their fancy warships and their fancy security measures. But again, like, you know, a terrorist, and I don't like to put my mind in what a terrorist is thinking, they're thinking about how I can, you know, murder innocent people. Why wouldn't they just go down the road to, like, you know, Gatwick and detonate a bomb there?
No, exactly. And actually, from what I heard, the very last leg of the torch run, you know, to the Olympics, is supposed to be delivered by a military helicopter, which I think maybe is going to something what you're hinting at, is that part of this is just to sort of show the power of the nation. You know, I mean, I had heard that this was a special year for the Queen or something, and maybe they're doing the whole pomp and ceremony just a little bit extra.
It's entirely possible.
But on a totally different area, but then again, oddly related to military, but in a way you might not think of directly. Now, as our listeners probably know, I do kind of like to, you know, make fun of religious people or backward people, and I love slamming stupid American policies. Well, sadly, there's an article I was reading recently that kind of combines all three. Now, first, some background. We may remember a few years back, there was an announcement about the eradication of sort of wild smallpox. That is, smallpox is extinct, and modern vaccination is the reason for it. There's been an ongoing effort to duplicate this victory over polio, a disease that used to strike fear into the hearts of our grandparents as thousands of children died each year in North America until like the 1950s when Canada's Jonas Salk created the polio vaccine. Thanks to aggressive vaccination, the polio virus has almost been eliminated from the planet. Now almost, because there have been some notable exceptions. In 2001, the global case count reached actually a record low of 483. And that's compared to what you would have had in the 60s and 70s, where it would have been like almost 100,000 people. So a very good thing. But politics and religion interfered, and the number rebounded to almost 2,000 cases in 2005. That said, you can't keep a good idea down. And currently in 2011, the count has been down to almost 650. Now, one of the areas of resurgence was in Nigeria, where sectarian fighting had led to sort of a mistrust of vaccinations, where they thought it was an attempt by Western powers to cause sterility in Muslim community. Crazy talk, but they have certain fears. However, rationality has sort of overcome this, and there were only 8 cases reported in 2011. Another hotspot was in India, but with, again, aggressive vaccination attempts to overcome infrastructure failures. That's sort of the big problem that India was having. Lots of population, but poor infrastructures. India has been polio-free since January 2011. The only place left where polio is endemic is Pakistan, and in particular, parts of the northern Waziristan region. This place may sound familiar because it's also a place where the U.S. has been waging a drone war on tribal Muslims who are also supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan. You may also remember Pakistan being in the news, about a year ago, when the Americans assassinated bin Laden. Now, I have no issues with the Yanks doing that, but how they did it has come back to sort of threaten thousands of kids now. In order to ensure that SEALs were killing the Osama bin Laden, if they got the right guy, the CIA had sent in a doctor to gain a blood sample from the bin Laden household. To do this, the doctor in question posed as part of a hepatitis vaccination program. The doctor has since been jailed for fraud. Now, some people in the U.S. and maybe Canada thought it was bad that the doctor was arrested because, hey, he helped kill bin Laden. But now you can kind of see, as we tie this together, why what he did was really kind of criminal. The people in Waziristan have refused to participate in the polio vaccination program because they fear, and rightfully I think, that the program may be used to help target drone assassination attacks. The tribal elders say that until the drone attack stopped, they will not allow vaccination of almost 250,000 children in the region. There's actually been an increase of almost 40% of polio cases in Pakistan in the last year. Now, on the one hand, we can, and I think justifiably, condemn the tribal elders for using their children as sort of pawns. I mean, they're literally putting their own safety ahead of their children. But on the other hand, they do have a point. When the CIA commandeered the vaccination program to forward its own aims, it made these programs political and thus vulnerable to retaliations. They're no longer seen as sort of a let's help the world, but hey, you might be, you know, you might be part of some big plot, and I'm not going to trust you. I know I can't trust scientists in general. Now I know why, because you're out to kill me. Did you see what I'm saying, Ethan?
Yeah, I do. I definitely see the connection. I'm a bit skeptical, though, of the real motives, I suppose you could say, of these, tribal elders. I honestly think that even if there hadn't been a doctor associated with the CIA program, they would still be speaking out against these polio vaccinations. I think that ignorance and their own political aspirations play a stronger role in this than we might give credit for. And I do think that the CIA made a major blunder by using the vaccination cover story. I think that just lends fuel to the fire. Now, that all being said, the people who generally believe that vaccinations, especially in this part of the world, are part of like a conspiracy to sterilize Muslims and that sort of thing, are a very extreme minority. It's not quite, as I would say, as problematic for vaccination efforts as, say, sort of more organized anti-vax network that's, you know, funded by people like Oprah and Jenny McCarthy and them. This is more of like a very fringe element in the world. But that being said, it is a disaster, because if we're so close to wiping out polio, and as we know, the more room you give a virus to exist, the more likely the chance that it will replicate or mutate, and you know, the vaccination could prove worthless at that point.
No, exactly. In fact, maybe this is all part of the Islamic plot to weaponize polio so that it can be used to attack the Olympic Games.
Now that sounds like a conspiracy.
We'll be right back with a bit more of perhaps conspiracy thinking after this break.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
this month in Discorder. Check out part two of our summer festival preview, which indulges you in the folky, the hippie, the eclectic, and the electronic. Discorder sits down with Hot Panda to talk about things like hot sauce, writing food blogs, and the ultimate battle for panda greatness. We also talk with the V Vecker Ensemble, who are the Captain Planet of Vancouver indie music. We talk with Ryan Smith of Green Burrito Records of the value of cassette tapes, and experience Sasquatch Music Festival through the eyes of Discorder. Don't forget to check out our regular columns like Filmstrip, where we review the film Better Than Something. Check out our events calendar for all the greatest upcoming shows, and our art project focusing on the work of Aaron Moran. You'll find the greatest in both recorded and live music in our Under Review and Real Life Action sections. All this and more in the July issue of Discorder, that magazine from CITR, on stands now.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can also listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes. And I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back. Now, we've been talking about conspiracy theories and things to make you fearful. Now, if you've seen the front cover of the Georgia Strait, you'll run as far as you can from your local fishmonger, perhaps pausing long enough to send his family a condolence letter. Why? Because Japanese radioactive fish have been caught off the BC coast, and they could kill you. Georgia Strait have been throwing around numbers like it's 5 times safe levels. Extreme cases are 187 times safe levels. So I thought I would check into this. Do we really have to worry about nuclear fish from Japan? First, I should state that I kind of accept the one premise that there isn't really a safe level of ionizing radiation. That is, anything that's ionized radiation could cause cancer. That said, we are exposed to this kind of radiation every day. For example, according to the WHO, your lovely banana or steak contains about 100 becquerels per kilo of radiation. And you go, what's a becquerel? I thought that too when I was reading it. Well, apparently there's like 3 major measures of radioactivity. The becquerel is sort of the number of emissions per second that the material is giving off. Think of this sort of as the little ticks you hear on a Geiger counter, sort of the speed of decay. Another measure is sieverts. This is the measure of potential ionizing radiation absorbed by the body. This is kind of the big number you always hear when they talk about sort of the health risks. It's always measured in sieverts. The last one I shall mention is called the Gray, which is named after Lord Gray. And this is a measure of the amount of energy actually absorbed. So this kind of differs from the sievert in that the first one is potential, whereas the Gray is actual radiation absorbed. It's actually measured in joules. Now, in the article, it states that almost 10% of fish caught off the Japanese coast exceed the 100 becquerel safety level. Now, of course, one of the problems right away with the article is that actually the Japanese safety level is actually 500 becquerels, and in Canada, it's 1,000. But again, I wanted to make it clear that I do kind of agree with the idea that, you know, we should keep an eye on the absorption level of toxins in fish, you know, that it's important for both public safety and for our understanding of the ecosystem. That said, this story largely was on the sort of fear-mongering, anti-corporate, anti-government regulation, it was kind of a menagerie of things, but it was definitely intended to make you fearful, at least in my opinion. The article pushed the, those numbers are high, it would give me pause from eating fish, quote, kind of angle, as well as calling for more testing by government, which again was ironic because it was complaining that the scientists in the government were saying there's no problem, but they want them to do more testing. There's also a call, of course, to lower the levels in Canada, where, say, 1,000 becquerel is the current level. They think, well, that's way too high. People are just popping off left, right, and center because of it. Again, an argument for a different day. So let's look at the number. First, if we did lower our level to 100 becquerels, which is implied by the numbers in the article, ironically enough, that would mean we'd end up banning bananas. A lot of people don't realize, but bananas actually have a lot, relatively speaking, of radioactive potassium, and it actually makes it one of the higher sources of natural radiation that we absorb every day. The WHO provided some numbers, and I thought they were quite good. So if an adult ate 500 grams of the fish contaminated with 1,000 becquerels per kilogram, what would be sort of the results? So I did the math, And apparently it would result of an exposure of 65/1000th of a millisievert. The average a person is exposed to in nature is 3.6 millisieverts. So that means you could eat, in theory, 275 kilograms of this highly exposed fish and still not even reach the amount you'd get just by sitting around doing nothing.
That's a lot of fish, too.
It is. It is a lot of fish. And it makes you just sit back and go, you know, you're mentioning a lot of fearful things here, but you're not putting them in any kind of real context and other than radiation bad, radiation causes cancer, any radiation's got to be bad. They make mention of the sort of highest cesium levels, and cesium-137 is the big one that they're talking about in the article, as being 18,700 becquerels. Now, that would result in an exposure of 0.12 millisieverts, which would be about the equivalent of two chest x-rays. Take note, of course, if you were having a spinal x-ray, it would actually be seven times more than this exposure. So again, it's not like I would recommend you going out and finding the most radioactive fish in the world, but even their worst case scenario is not that bad, assuming you're not a vegetarian who only ever eats fish. They ask why it's not been picked up in the news. And as you know, I am no defender of corporate media, but it seems like in this particular case, there isn't really a story to tell. Unless, of course, you want to gain some sort of cheap ratings by running sort of a fear-mongering story. And again, considering this made the front page and the actual lack of fearful or informative things was quite lacking, it seemed quite appropriate. Now, just to add to the sort of angle, they had mentioned that so much of the fish, you know, were containing this radioactive cesium as though it wasn't in the system prior. Yet in other parts of the article, they keep comparing how much radioactive cesium the fish had prior to the Fukushima nuclear accident, which of course is what they think is causing all this, versus post. So they say in one part, oh my God, it's so rare that they have this radioactive cesium. And then another part they say, oh no, it's a common part. It's just increased and there's more of it. They also mentioned that scientists had said, and this I think is an important thing for us to catch because it can be confusing, and they had a point with it in one sense, that scientists had said that the maximum exposure due to the runoff from the nuclear plants had occurred last year. And again, I'm not a big trusting person of the big corporations, but I'm going to take it with a grain of salt for the moment. That could be true, and you can still see an increased amount of cesium contamination in the fish. And they sort of say, why are the numbers rising? Well, the simple answer is something called the food chain. A small little creature eats a bit of the radioactive cesium. Then another fish comes by and eats a lot of these little fish, and it concentrates as you move up move up the food chain. Thus, you get an increased concentration until, of course, it's eventually excreted out of the whole system, hopefully decayed into the ocean's bottom. So again, parts of this I didn't mind because, hey, you know, I think we should keep an eye on corporations and, you know, you shouldn't trust everyone. But they put such a horrific spin on it that it ruined the whole thing. It made me just fearful and untrusting of scientists in general, because they say you can't trust the scientists because they're lying to you. Corporations, which I don't trust anyhow. But my food itself, it seemed like such a misdirect in an article.
Well, you know, I looked at this article and one thing immediately jumped out at me, and that was the author of the article is Alex Roslin. Now, that may not sound crazy or anything, but I looked at some of the articles that Roslin has written, and there is a lot of anti-science articles, not to mention the Fukushima fallout has been sort of a favorite topic of this particular writer. He's written about six or seven articles, all of them very poor science, very, very poorly researched. And I've actually seen some pretty good skeptical takedowns on things like Skeptic North. And I think we at Radio Freethinker have actually debunked a couple of the articles in the past. There's also been a number of anti-vax articles as well published by this author. And, you know, looking at the past sort of case that this person has been presenting on the subject of science and, quote unquote, trusting the establishment, it's hard to get any credibility for these articles. You know what I mean? Because there's this past record of just not publishing very well-researched material and very alarmist, fear-mongering material. Material that has been debunked many times. I mean, a quick Google search of some of these issues would clear you right up. and this person clearly hasn't done that. So I'm incredibly skeptical of any article that this person publishes.
You know, and this points to another thing that I've mentioned before, is that I'm not so much against people, you know, being slightly distrustful of corporations or some of the regulations, because you need to keep your eyes open. But when you do this misdirect, you're wasting your time on false issues when you really should be focusing on the real issues. I was just listening today about one of the companies designed to clean up the Fukushima plant had been putting lead paper over their radiation measurement machines so they could get workers to work longer. Now, those are like, okay, those are good things. We should be worried about that. And we should be spending our time worrying about those sort of things that are actually genuinely concerns than these sort of fake controversies that just seem to really just seem to be pushing an agenda that's not a good agenda.
I totally agree with that one. Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back with an explanation of why I have a problem with the War of 1812.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So our next topic is the War of 1812. And no, you're not going crazy. We have discussed this before, way back in episode 107. Now, when we did that episode, we were actually discussing it in the context of a recently announced celebration. This was back when Parliament was in, quote, crisis and was about to launch a federal election. Ah, I remember those days. While we talked about some of the history behind the conflict, we also kind of wondered what kind of tone would be set by the celebration of history. Would it be sort of an accurate educational look back on understanding the context and reality of the war? Or would it be an excuse to get all patriotic and give a collective rah-rah?
Let me guess. Canadians, we're humble. We're not the kind of people to boast. So it would have been a, you know, one of those vignette sort of thing you see on the CBC back in the day when the CBC was real. And it was just pure history and context and provided great understanding. Am I right? I mean, the government wouldn't try and make something too weird about this, would they?
Well, unfortunately, it seems more like we're doing the rah-rah thing. Which, don't get me wrong, I love the rah-rah. That's great. But I'm also a fan of history and facts. So I wanted to discuss some of the memes that have been popping up with the War of 1812 Bicentennial. And you know, I'm not trying to rain on the parade. I think understanding the past is great. And I've actually seen some pretty cool things. They've got, in Vancouver, actually, a big free museum that you can go to. And they have, like, a cannon that fires off. And they have cool little things that people can learn about. I think that part is great. I love that. But there's some other things that are happening that I think are really not helping us understand our history very well.
You mean like the shooting gallery they have at the Peace Gardens, you know, where you get to shoot Americans just to celebrate Canada Day?
I don't think that's part of the celebration. But I do actually want us to take a listen to actually a pretty common PSA that's appearing on Canadian TV. It's from the Canadian Mint.
The War of 1812 series from the Royal Canadian Mint. We fought at sea and on land. We faced relentless American fire and stood our ground. We came together as never before to shape our own future. And, in time, create our own country.
The War of 1812, HMS Shannon $2 coin. Another great Canadian story to hold on to.
Okay, so you might ask, what in the world is wrong with that? So, to start with, the voiceover says, quote, "we." And in this context, the "we" represents Canada. Now, this is incorrect. What people seem to be forgetting is that this war was not fought between Canada and the U.S. It was fought between Great Britain and the U.S. Now, why does this matter? There is an interesting thing in history where we tend to treat nations like actors. We say things like Germany invaded Poland or France responded with an attack. And we talk about them as if they're characters in a play. And what this language obscures is that countries don't suddenly become, well, characters in a play. But for the sake of brevity and understanding, we tell our history as though the nation is acting with one unified voice, even though sometimes the nation as a whole wasn't united at all. Now, a good example of this is in Canada, how Quebec has been, well, forever really, but particularly very uninterested in international wars like the First World War.
Actually, that's a good point because, I mean, Quebec, you know, there was real fear of civil unrest because people in Quebec were really, really upset about conscription because they thought, well, this is Britain's war. This is not our war. What have we got to do with this? And it was a major issue. Although on the sort of one note, just to point in there before you go too far, in one way, this is actually a very Canadian war in the one sense that it was probably the only real war that on the continent where First Nations people played a major role in the battle. I mean, you know, like you had the Iroquois Nation, all them who were fighting as sort of equal partners with the British Army. I mean, equal, relatively speaking.
Right. Actually, that's a good point. Let's come back to that in a little bit. But getting back to the idea of sort of referring to countries as actors, when we're talking about empires, and, you know, the British Empire was, of course, a globe-spanning empire, when the mother nation went to war, its colonies did as well. And this has real implications for telling our history, because when colonies were part of an empire, they didn't have a choice. It wasn't like Great Britain sent us a telegram saying, hey, we're going to invade Germany. Do you guys want to take along? It was just sort of Canada was automatically at war when Britain went to war. Now, this fact allows us to see important game-changing moments in history, such as when colonies started deciding whether or not to go to war on their own and not at the call of the motherland. This is exactly what happened with Canada in World War II. Britain declared war. Canada, for different reasons, but all of them fairly important, didn't declare war for about 2 weeks. Now, another problem with the PSA is that it's kind of playing fast and loose with the facts. Now, neither Canada nor America was prepared or really eager to fight this war. And there were a number of limited and very poorly organized invasions of Canada by American troops. Now, one such invasion actually fled without a shot being fired. So this idea that, you know, Canada stood as this united front against American invasion is kind of a misnomer, and it's not really a fair thing to say, because Canada didn't really stand as a united front. In fact, one of the kind of strange ironies of the war is that a lot of people on this kind of messy border between Canada and the U.S. probably didn't care very much who was in charge. They were paying taxes to either nation, and they honestly didn't care as long as they weren't being shot at. Now, the other sort of aspect of this is this notion that, you know, these nations, Canada and the U.S., came together and developed this really unique and important identity in fighting this war. Now, even that is kind of not really true because, well, the French and English-speaking parts of Canada are still, were still deeply divided, and they wouldn't really mend until, well, never, I guess. And, you know, this is a pretty important factor because if we're going to talk about, you know, this war as its importance to Canada, then the issue should not really be something that was a sort of a non-existing identity, but the real context. Things like the fact that, this actually did see a rise of loyalist mentality in Canada. And if anything, that resulted in a stronger push towards remaining part of the British Empire and less interested in independence. And Don mentioned the addition of First Nations in the war. Well, the context for them, unfortunately, was pretty tragic. The war was basically an excuse for the British and the Americans to use their sort of proxy allies to annihilate each other and then take their land. It was a pretty horrible thing. Unfortunately, I really haven't seen that narrative represented in our history, which is another tragic example of not telling the whole story.
No, and actually, in some ways, we try and gloss it up. I mean, Americans don't think a lot about the War of 1812, but in many ways, I think it was more important for them in some degrees. I mean, one, the Battle of New Orleans is very famous. The Battle of Baltimore, where they had the Star-Spangled Banner, came out. But one of the things that the War of 1812 had showed the United States is that it was very confused as a nation. I mean, remember, the United States had only formed a couple of decades earlier. And when these armies came across to attack Canada, they did it hither and thither. You know, you had a bunch of guys here say, hey, let's just go, because they didn't really have a standing army. And one of the things that it kind of showed the Americans is that if they're going to get involved in any military campaign, they need to be much more sort of adult about it, and that sort of the adolescence of nationhood was over for them. It was sort of a good wake-up call for the Americans and helped them sort of reorganize how they did things.
Yeah, exactly. The American invasions into Canada were really poorly organized. And ultimately, I think where the American identity comes from, I mean, they did get some because the Star-Spangled Banner is based on the defense of Baltimore. These were all based on major offenses by the British, wholly British forces. We're not talking about like Canadian troops. We're talking about like fleets of British ships attacking American cities. And again, all of them were really unsuccessful. But it's important to remember that the Canadian aspect of this war was really focused on a militia, a group of well-meaning Canadian folk who rallied together, you know, maybe a couple 5,000 or so size militia force that augmented the existing British Defense Force in Canada. So the British committed a pretty sizable force, about 48,000 by the end of the war. Now, the Canadian contingent was significantly smaller than that. Now, not to minimize that addition, it's really important, but to suggest that this was a Canadian victory, it's just false. And it does a disservice to our unique history as a nation, because really what this showed, especially for the British, was that, hey, we don't want to defend Canada. So from now on, let's not, you know, antagonize the U.S. Let's try to be not allies, but a bit more friendly with the Americans and avoid having to commit large-scale troops to defend really what are a couple poorly populated colonies. And this attitude by Britain forced the, you know, early political entities in Canada to adopt a very different attitude. And it launched our own movement for forming a nation. But it wasn't out of, yay, we kicked the Americans' butt, now we're a nation. It was about, you know, Britain is distancing itself from us. We need to start identifying what we want to build in our nation, what we want to have to defend ourselves and to seek our own fortunes in the world. So, you know, you might say, Ethan, it's just an ad for the Canadian Mint. And I agree, it's just an ad for the Canadian Mint, but this is part of a larger narrative that is existing out there. And I see this in commercials, I see this in literature and newspapers, and we're educating a whole generation of Canadians with this campaign. And that's great for the most part, but we need to educate them on the actual realities of the situation, the historic context. And we're not doing a very good job about that. So some people have said to me in frequent conversations that I'm trying to split hairs, you know, that even though it wasn't really Canada, it kind of was Canada because, you know, there was Upper and Lower Canada. Well, that's not Canada, okay? Like, Canada didn't form until we had a pretty important meeting in the Maritimes. And, you know, if we're going to talk about Canadian identity, we need to base it on, you know, defensible ideas, ideas that have facts to back them up. And we can't just gussy up a war and call it the birth of Canada.
I actually think there's another angle on this that is quite relevant to today. Because as you point out, in some ways, you can kind of dismiss this as, well, who cares? It happened like, you know, over 100 years ago. Big deal, 200 years ago. But recently, Canada's had a sort of a shift in its identity, especially with regards to the idea of militarism. I mean, if you go back to when I was growing up and, you know, a couple of decades ago, Canada was famous for being the peacekeepers of the world, the Blue Berets, that, you know, we were not a war nation. We were a peace nation. We got people together and we solved problems together. But at least in the last, I don't know, 10 years, maybe less, there's been this real shift to turn our focus from being peacekeepers into a military power. I mean, with our an invasion of Afghanistan, the current stance that we have with regards to other nations around the world, currently we're buying the F-35 jet fighters, which just really seems to be putting Canada into a really militaristic sort of bent. And I think where the War of 1812 plays into this isn't so much the facts or falsities of the historical claims, but how they can be manipulated to create this bigger image of Canada, not as a peaceful nation, but as a warring nation, as an empire to be. Okay, empire to be is a bit pushing it. But I mean, you know, we are no longer seeing the end result of diplomatic negotiations as peace, but regime change.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the changing face of Canadian diplomacy has always been a curious one because, as you say, Canada was never really a military power. Although we did have a fairly sizable navy and army after the major wars, but that was because we had built it up over the course. Canada's strength in diplomacy has always been in our ability to mediate disputes. That's where Canada earned its prestige. And for some people, that's not very satisfying. They want to hear about battles, and they want to hear about nations building empires and achieving their self-worth on the battlefield, which I think is kind of an unfortunate way of looking at things. Nations don't need to be born on battlefields. They can be, but they don't have to be. Nations can be built on consensus building and other forms of achieving great works. So when, you know, Canada celebrates a war, and, you know, the philosophical question of when do you celebrate a war always comes up, but we can leave that for another time. But when Canada makes a big deal about our past military conflicts, we shouldn't be focusing on how we can make Canada sound like a mighty nation. We should be focusing on how that conflict affected the lives of Canadians, how we went about accomplishing things, how we went about building things that we can be proud of, whether that's small-scale things like how did families make do without, you know, their husbands, their fathers, their brothers when they went off to fight in war, or whether we're talking about, you know, how cities developed and how, you know, Canadians were able to interact with each other. I mean, the French-English divide remains to this day, and a lot of it comes from Canada's history of war.
Well, you know, there's actually another point, I think, and I'm going to contrast something, because I think this War of 1812 is a good thing, because again, War of 1812, hey, it's when Canada burnt down the White House. Compare that to actually what I always thought was Canada's sort of military defining moment, which would be something like Vimy Ridge. And Vimy Ridge is in one sense sort of seen as, you know, a Canadian military triumph. You know, we held back the Huns and it was great. But what really made that a binding Canadian story was the fact that so many people died. Every community in the country, you know, lost so many people that we sort of bled to our maturity. That it was like, it was such a horrific blow and we took it. And that sort of proved our maturity, is that it wasn't this glory about, hey, we rubbed someone's nose in it, but we were a strong enough nation to suffer this horrific blow of World War I and still become a strong nation afterwards. And I mean, it's a good or interesting dichotomy between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Canada does have famous battles that it was part of. And we do have a really important history when it comes to, you know, major conflicts in the world. And Vimy Ridge is a great example. So is, you know, the Battle of the Somme and those famous World War I battles. But the important aspect, of course, is getting the facts right. And ultimately, I'm very skeptical of the way that we've been presenting the material as a nation for World War, for the War of 1812. And I hope that listeners can keep in mind that while it's great to have those rah-rah moments, it's also really important that we understand the context.
So, Ethan, I'm going to put you on the spot here, and then you can have your last comment. So how would you do it differently?
Well, you know, I think that there's some good intentions here. I think that the idea of having, you know, museums and exhibits and a public awareness campaign, those can all be good things. But for me, you know, it should be less about the sort of emotional, we beat the Americans in a war, let's feel good about ourselves, to more understanding context. And I keep saying context, but what I'm trying to get across here is that, you know, wars don't happen in a vacuum, and there are things that happen before a war, during a war, and after a war. And rarely is the most important thing the battles. It's almost always the important things are the things that happen to, you know, normal human beings. And I mentioned that there's a very unfortunate absence of Native inclusion in this awareness campaign. I think that that's a really shameful thing. I mean, we really need to be examining their role in Canada's history far more than we have been. And so if I was going to do things differently, you know, if I was going to do things differently, there'd be education, there'd be exhibits, but I wouldn't be trying to spin this as some kind of major victory. I'd be trying to actually educate people and engage them and sink into their critical thinking skills and ask them hard questions. But again, you know, that's not for everybody, I suppose.
No, and of course, the other thing, just to screw with your mind, is I wonder if, you know, the War of 1812 didn't happen, whether Louisiana would have remained French or not.
Well, I mean, part of the reason why Louisiana went to America was because Napoleon sold it to them so that he could pay for his wars in Europe, which is one of the reasons why the British really don't care about the War of 1812. They were kind of busy fighting Napoleon.
True. But I wonder if he would have sold it to someone who wasn't a loyal ally. Because, I mean, by attacking Canada, i.e. the British, sorry, that made them, you know, oh, you're on our side, so I'll sell it to you. As opposed to, let's say, the Spanish.
Yeah, fair enough. Although, I mean, the question remains is who else would have bought it. But, you know, interesting historic question there.
Yes. I imagine there's some cabal of Illuminati were interested, but lost their chance.
Well, you know, they're always in the background, moving pieces. But anyway, we are out of time on Radio Free Thinking. We should probably go to our skeptical highlights.
I've got one skeptical highlight this week. Apparently, there is going to be the International Autonomous Robot Racing Competition of 2012, going to be held on the 28th of July. Essentially, it's where they get together and they're going to have like a design competition. They're going to have a drag racing, a circuit racing. But the robots themselves are essentially ideas of artificial intelligence where they got to race without any human control. It sounds like a real cool thing. Now, from what I understand, this is largely for kids. Sorry, Ethan, I don't think we can participate. But it still seems like a very interesting, very cool, very interesting to show up. The actual details I'm going to have on our website because, again, their website's you need a robot to navigate it. But it's going to be at UBC. It's going to be this coming Saturday. So show it. Take up. See. Maybe it's the beginning of the robot revolution that will take over the world. You never know.
Well, yeah, maybe. My skeptical highlight, I got a couple of events here to mention to local skeptics. Coming up on the 1st of August is the August Skeptics in the Pub in Kitsilano. This, of course, takes place at the Billy Bishop Legion, which is appropriate for today's topic, in Vancouver. So check that out. A great time is always had by all. Later on in the month of August, it's going to be a busy month for skeptical events. The humanists are marching in the Pride Parade. And they're getting together at Robson Street and Thurlow Street. And the sort of skeptic community free thought group that exists in Vancouver has participated in the Pride Parade for about 3 years now in a row, I think. So check that out. It's always a lot of fun. Even if you don't want to march in the parade, if you just want to go and check it out, really cool. And there'll be a sizable contingent of free thinkers there. So that's always fun. And then coming up a bit later on in the month is a lecture by one Paul Ingram, who is a well-known skeptic in the community. He runs the website saveyourself.com, and he's giving a talk for the BC Humanists at the Oak Ridge Senior Center, and that is on Sunday, August 26th at 10 a.m. So that should also be very interesting, so check that one out as well.
Cool. Sounds very fun.
Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on. Bye, everyone.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space, somewhere else in time.
The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? The Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean.
recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.